Concession number 1747, reel 26.
Reel 25. You're explaining why, in your opinion, Major Churchill didn't have the essential qualities required of a commanding officer. I think you said a sense of proportion.
Yes, I think he had a number of the qualities. He was very competent, and he was pretty fearless. He was nobody's fool, but I think he had the lack of confidence, which I guess a good many territorials must have had, of a slight difficult to pin down inferiority complex at the side of the regular army, and also, I mean, partly because of the nature of having been a territorial, he may have been too paradoxically too tied by the book. He knew what ought to be done in theory, but I think a little more personal flair and imagination may be necessary. He wouldn't easily break the rules. This became clear to me over the months ahead in various small ways.
Could you explain one or two of these small
ways?
Well,
I can explain one of them, which was that... it was a personal thing, really, when we were in Egypt some months later, and I was the only person in the regiment, apart from the CO, who was having to work very hard indeed, because I was duty officer, intelligence officer, acting adjutant, the adjutant being on leave, and Churchill ordered a 7 a.m. PE parade, drill, on the open sand outside our tents in Egypt every morning, and after a solid day with the colonel working in headquarters whilst everybody else was disporting themselves, I was 5 minutes late for this PE, and he immediately, without question, exerted his authority by ordering me to do orderly officer duties for the next 3 days, which meant, as well as everything else I was doing, I'd now have to mount the guard morning and evening, and so on. And it was... I made no comment, how could one? But it was so obviously unfair and unquestioning. It was playing by the book, and indeed when I had to put on my Sam Brown and say to the colonel at 6 o'clock the next evening, "I'm sorry, I've got to go and mount the guard," he said, "What on earth are you talking about?" And I hadn't told him about this punishment by the CO2. But then I had to, because I was walking out of the tent headquarters to go and mount the guard. And I said, "I've got to mount the guard." He said, "Why?" So I told him. He said, "Leave it to me." And, you know, this was the difference between using a bit of sense and not using any sense.
It's odd that he should be lacking in confidence if he'd won an MC and bar.
It wasn't lacking in confidence at carrying out orders, but you don't... I mean, winning an MC and bar isn't necessarily done through... I mean, it can be sheer cool courage, which in Churchill's case I think it was. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're showing flair. It could be that you didn't have the flair to run away. You know what I mean? Flair works in a number of directions. Lack of imagination can produce many an MC.
How long was Major Churchill in charge then, as acting CO?
Well, this was his second stint.
Yes.
And it didn't last long because, as we shall see, the 6th of February, we saw the CO off the premises, and he went back to Naples. And
do you know what happened to him afterwards?
I think that he was... given another pit, made into a full colonel, and put in charge of a prisoner of war camp, though that's only hearsay.
Sounds like being rewarded for failure.
I make no comment. Now, there, by the 7th of February, we have again rumours about going home. And then we hear more firmly that 46 and 5 divisions are to do a pincer attack. And the next day, the 8th of February, the plans are laid for the next attack on Mount Damiano, and by three divisions this time. That would be ourselves and 46 and 5.
Would you be in the centre of that line-up?
I rather think so. If they were going to be the pincers, it rather looks as though we were going up the middle. Indeed, that would tally with what we were saying a few days ago in the diary about 5 division being next to the coast, then us, and then 46.
Being in the mountainside.
Being on the mountainside, that's right. So we planned the next Damiano attack, and I was up again north of the Garigliano on the 9th and 10th doing a reconnaissance for attack headquarters, and then walked back quite a distance. I don't know why. There must have been some problem about the jeep at 3 p.m. Then things begin to happen at a colossal rate. We're given orders, shingle, 3 hours' notice. Now, shingle, 3 hours' notice was the code word for the Anzio bridgehead. This would be
so
on...
So this means you were 3 hours' notice to move out of your sector and
be
transported up to Anzio.
That's right.
And had plans been made for that withdrawal, for transport and logistic arrangements to get you out?
Well, I don't think the withdrawal perhaps loomed large at this moment, because although I said on the previous day or two that we were planning a three-divisional attack on Damiano, it hadn't begun. So presumably the plans for that were in the process of being cancelled as part of the... our withdrawal was part of that operation. So it wouldn't be a matter of withdrawing from a battle situation, but rather one of redistributing troops along the front, part of the front that we were vacating.
So you're in contact with the enemy, but you weren't actually engaged.
That's right, that's right. I mean, it was artillery contact, not much infantry action at that time. And the reasons, I suppose, are fairly obvious, that the Germans were pulling out north to go and attack Anzio. We were being pulled out south to go and reinforce it. So there was a curious sort of reconcentration by both sides, realignment towards the Anzio bridgehead. And indeed, we were told to move, packed up our HQ, 3 hours sleep, and then move off at 6 a.m. to a concentration area, which was a field full of mud, near a place called Pozzuoli, north of Naples, which I think is a place of some archaeological interest there. I've never been back there. It rained solidly, and you asked when Major Churchill ceased to be acting CO. It was that afternoon, because a new commanding officer arrives to take Colonel Oldfield's place. He comes from 5 Division. He is 6 feet 5 high, and is Colonel Zambra, part of the family of Negretti and Zambra, who before the war were the great optical firm in London, rangefinders, binoculars, all that kind of thing.
And it sounds like he was of Italian descent.
Indeed it does, indeed it does, though there's no sign of this. I mean, he was the archetypal either public school or direct Sandhurst Woolwich product. A regular.
How did you get on with him?
Well, fine. On the whole, yes. He was, I thought, a wholly admirable man. I've got a photo there, which I'll show you when we've finished, of him. The news from Anzio is not good. I liaise with 167 Brigade, who were going to Anzio Bridgehead with us, and thereby managed to get a night's sleep away from our own telephones with them in a house. 11th and 12th February, wait and do nothing in the rain with hundreds of vehicles.
All in this muddy field?
All in this muddy field, yes. Well, it's more than a field. It was a huge area, I suppose, for a whole regiment and so on. And then I went off in a jeep at 4:30 to Naples, to recover our regiment's staff car from Colonel Oldfield, who had taken it with his bombardier when he made his unfortunate departure from the regiment. And I had a very pleasant 3 hours with him and another colonel, who Colonel Oldfield being, as I've put, a much chastened man, and there was no longer any nastiness or arrogance towards me. I was greeted like an old friend. And
that might have been rather alarming.
Well, I make no comment. It was snow and sleet to the Serena Hotel. 3 hours with him, drink, buy 1,000 cigarettes and 48 chocolate bars before gliding back. These were not for myself, I might add. Before gliding back, driven in the staff car to a sea of mud where we shiver and doze until dawn. Then it turns warmer and we move off about noon. This is the 12th of February, Saturday. A slow convoy to Pozzuoli port, where we hang around the port area and are slightly concerned to see shrapnel holes in lifeboats which are over the side of the tank landing and other invasion ships. Eventually board landing craft number 425 Royal Navy. Sail in the evening.
Was this a landing craft tank, an LCT?
As opposed to LST? No, that's LST and LCT are the same thing, aren't they?
Well, a landing craft is smaller than a landing ship.
Yes, these were big. I mean, these were big things.
Big
yes.
ships.
Oh, yes, yes. Big things. With a significant deck for people to sleep on and so on, and the ability to go right round the outside as you would on a cruise liner.
Yes.
And the rails. And a huge cavernous thing. Well, it had to hold our guns, but nothing else.
What else went onto it besides your guns?
Well, quite a lot of vehicles. I don't remember any tanks going on.
This was like a row ferry, was it?
That's right. Just so. It was the same sort of thing as the thing we had landed from at Salerno.
Right. How did you actually get onto it? Well, did you go on from a jetty or quay?
Yes,
or
it was a good port, Pozzuoli. I mean, it was a viable port for doing this kind of operation.
So you weren't landing off from driving on over a beach or anything of that sort?
No, not. Oh, no. This is a built-up port.
Right.
I mean, it was like doing it from Folkestone or something like that. We sailed in the evening, a pleasant wardroom and a good bunk. Make the best of a night at sea. Sunday, 13th February, we had something to eat at 5:30 a.m. and we caught sight of Anzio on a sunny morning and make promptly into the port. There are dive bombing attacks out of the sun, quite terrifying noise, hence delays as in unloading as we sit there, an easy target.
But you were actually in the harbour.
We're actually outside the harbour.
Outside the harbour.
Yes, were you
anchored? Or
we were waiting. I wouldn't know whether we were anchored. I would have thought we were just sauntering without being at anchor. I doubt whether it would have anchored. Well, it's probably fairly deep water there. I would think that the naval, the crew, would want to be as mobile as possible.
Exactly, yes.
Take evasive action or to be called in quickly and get out again. Now, I don't think the question of anchoring arose. It wasn't that sort of situation.
Was there any direct attack on your ship specifically by the dive bombers?
Very difficult to know because they didn't hit us, but we saw bombs, I suppose, 100 yards away landing in the sea. I mean, it was quite close enough to be hairy.
Quite close, yes.
Yes.
Did you see any friendly aircraft?
Not at that point, no, although there must have been. And, of course, one mustn't forget the fact the Navy was roundabout, too.
So presumably there was a fair amount of flak going up against
the flak, yes. There was all hell was let loose, in fact. Then we got off the boat and went into a concentration area where I've put, and I remember it very well, there were thousands of vehicles, a huge traffic jam. I think there were some very caustic comments in Churchill's History of the War about the amount of transport needed by the Americans wherever they went, and this was largely an American landing. And I think there were nearly as many vehicles as men. I mean, the thing was just like a car park.
Was the port workable? Did you land dry?
Oh, yes, we did. Yes, we landed at a jetty. What we didn't know then was that Major Healy was the harbour master.
What condition was the town in when you went
through
it?
It was wreckage. It was just terrible wreckage. I mean, it had been a peaceful landing, I gather, 3 weeks before, and with no damage at all, but it had been knocked to hell since then. It was fairly peaceful when we actually landed, though we heard horrific tales of air raids and shelling, because the entire bridgehead was within easy reach of the steadily growing German encirclement with guns. So we were all a sitting target, the whole thing.
Was there any incoming artillery fire as you were landing?
It wasn't that first day, no. No, we were lucky to be able to land and disperse without being actually bombed.
Well, what time of day did you go ashore?
Well, this was... we had, as I say, we ate at 5.30 in the morning, and I would guess that we went ashore by about 7.30, 8. It was breakfast time.
Did you know where you were going before you landed?
You mean literally where we were going?
Yes, you any idea which, you know, where you were going to go?
No, we didn't.
It was just a case of getting ashore and then finding
orders
and directions.
Yes, that's right. I visited brigade headquarters, 167, and then went to 1st Division, HQRA. 1st Division, that must have been a British division, yes. That's right. And find to my astonishment that they've already got a field bakery and even a field cashier in place. This surprised me so much because it took many weeks for us to get the bakery into Salerno, let alone the field cashier. And I remember as it got dark, I saw the flares of night bombing planes for the first time since 1941. And that was in Lincolnshire, where I live. Spent the night on duty in the office truck. That was this sort of mobile office caravan affair, which I mentioned in the context of Colonel McCracken, particularly, who virtually lived in it. And I commented rather wryly that I was on the verge of new adventures, new TAC HQs, and a brand new CO. Third one in 2 months. Now less than 30 miles from Rome, performing murder at its gates.
Where was this headquarters you went to visit, the first of headquarters? Was that in the town?
I can't remember. No, there was no town. Everything was caravaned or tented or dug in. The town had ceased to exist for workable purposes. There would have been no comfort in being at the town. The target was so obvious.
What was the countryside like, the ground?
It was interesting ground because it was, I don't know what the right term is, riddled with wadis. It was very much a place which had always had these rapid streams which had cut deeply into sandstone and made very deep ravines. And when these were dry, as they were at this particular time, they were sort of natural semi-submerged walkways. They were not level enough, of course, for vehicles to go along, but as cover for pedestrian access, they were excellent. And a lot of us owed our lives to these things. But for the rest, it was a fair amount of thick wood, some agriculture, horticulture, fields of olives, tomatoes, that kind of thing. And not very wide roads. It was a rural, fairly, lush sort of landscape.
What could you see looking inland?
You could see the Alban Hills where the Pope lived, his summer palace. I thought of him often with envy. We were overlooked by the Alban Hills, and we were conscious of being sitting ducks.
You'd said earlier on, if it comes to the Pope and popish things, that you'd felt a certain conscience at knocking down the church tower.
Yes. Oh, I don't think that was anything to do with being religious, because I had never really been very religious. It was just a superstition that church towers are not things that you knock down, even if you're an agnostic. It was nothing more specialised than that in my case.
Wasn't a question of going to see the padre.
Oh, no.
More a fear that the bogeyman might come and get you.
No, just a general distaste for knocking down church towers, or indeed anything else, but particularly church towers. It seemed, even to a pagan, it seemed slightly sacrilegious. One would have felt perhaps the same about aiming at a Muslim minaret.
So it's a general idea of what the country was like in Anzio.
Yes.
So have you any idea why you had to go to 1st Division headquarters? Was this acting as a general administrative headquarters for everyone landing in the bridgehead, or was there some other reason?
I wish I could remember it better, whether we took over from 1st Division, which I think we possibly did.
So
he certainly took over from some other division that was being pulled out. Although I think it was an American division, the 3rd Division, 3rd American. It was a general liaison visit, I mean, to get to know the people one would be in touch with. Mm. It was all very compact. I mean, the whole perimeter when we got there of the Anzio Bridgehead could not have been, I suspect, more than at the most 15 miles. At its longest, and that was a sort of ice cream cone shaped thing coming to a point at Nettuno Anzio.
So you would have been subject to fire from all the way around the perimeter.
Oh, yeah. Yes, that's right. That's right. I mean, there are road maps that show you later, but it's since they can't be interpreted onto audio tape, there's not much point in going into it, but I mean, anybody listening to this and then looking at the map will see what I'm saying in outline. We were in an inverted triangle. And I mentioned seeing flares of night bombing. I imagine that was our own night bombing, although it could have been Germans bombing us as well. Both do a reconnaissance on Monday the 14th of February for in the area where we would establish a tactical headquarters, TAC HQ. That's right. Then pack up and move with a jeep shuttle service to take over an American position. They are being pulled out for a rest. I think it was troops of the American 3rd Division. We take over heaps of rations and weapons, etc. They've simply left.
And well, they'd left them dumped.
Yes,
in
we're very
positions.
Grateful for the rations. Mm. And we obviously had no use for any field artillery there, because ours was different. But it wasn't that which they left. But presumably they left things like Tommy guns, which were useful. They had quite a lot of Tommy guns, and we didn't.
Did you normally carry a personal weapon?
I carried a revolver.
Did you regard that as being useful?
Not really, no, except to polish myself off with if necessary. But no, there was always a fairly ready access in the scout car or whatever to a Tommy gun or a rifle, or indeed a Bren. I mean, the Bren was the thing we'd all been trained on until we realised how popular the Tommy guns were, how simple and light. We took over these rations and weapons, and also took over a small dugout, but it was hopeless for the colonel and myself to try to work in this dark dugout in the dark, so I parked the CO in the dugout with a telephone and I spent the night in the frosty open air. Fortunately, we had a quiet night. On Tuesday the 15th, I dug in all the morning and afternoon, and the new CO was going round the troops. He was well out of my way. I didn't see him.
What were you digging? Were you digging a personal...
It wasn't so much personal slit trench as something more substantial than that to house command equipment. In other words, to be able to have a bit of a cover over it, where you could have a light underneath to read the maps. It's rather important. And to house at least two telephones.
Right,
and, of course, a radio. Mm.
So in a basic command post, that's all which you were having to improvise and which would have to operate under fire.
Yes, the most basic sort of command post.
The most basic command post. Yeah. You would need your map boards.
Light.
A light. Telephones.
Yep.
And a wireless set.
That's right.
And that would that be it?
Well, basically it would be, apart from personal weapon.
And who would be in this?
Just
dugout?
The CO and I remember it very well.
Just two of us.
Yes.
And you would be acting as RHQ.
We were RHQ for practical purposes, yes. Mm. I mean, we were not physically with our own 167 Brigade Infantry.
Mm. Where were they?
I don't know. Just trying to think where they were. Mm. They can't have been far away, because the colonel had to be within more or less walking distance of them. So they were probably in a nearby...
Would it be right to suppose that one of your telephone links would be to 167 headquarters, to the brigade headquarters?
Yes, it would. That would be a reasonable supposition.
And where would the other
would
go?
The other would be back to our proper RHQ.
Main RHQ.
Yes, so that they could contact the batteries to give orders.
Yeah,
that's right. I remember this quite well because we... had to bolster our morale as best we could. We found some bales of straw and we heaped them up around the edges of this dugout, and indeed used bales of straw supported by one or two timbers as a roof, which gave us a kind of makeshift hut, kidding ourselves that this straw would be proof against shrapnel or airbursts, which of course it wouldn't have been. Furthermore, of course, it was an obvious fire risk. But...
it would keep the light in.
It would keep the light in, yes, that's right. And this digging was just in time as a mixed stonk barrage of high explosive and airburst comes just as we get inside this thing and kills two and wounds several other Americans who are on a nearby track, part of their withdrawal from the front.
So in other words, the enemy artillery caught you doing the relief.
It seems to have caught part of it, yes, that's right.
So relief is a really juicy target, isn't it, for artillery?
What, you mean this is the critical time to catch people when they're on the move? Yeah. Yes, I suppose it is. But I suppose the Germans... whether they knew we were being relieved or that the Americans were being relieved or not. Mm. I mean, it was so small, the area, that they must have been, they were bound to hit something wherever they fired. And they'd no doubt been firing at a selection of fixed targets. And I don't doubt that where we were was just such an area.
Was this a long bombardment or a short one?
I think it was a short one. I remember it very well because I was almost beyond caring by this time, and I was wandering around looking at the sky, waiting for see which way these airbursts were coming from, and the colonel thought I was bomb happy and just wondering, which I wasn't. But, I mean, he called me, and I remember a sort of note of agitation in his voice. Come here. And, of course, I turned round and said, it's all right. So I went, rejoined him. We got on with our work. I remember the It's the first time I'd, since Salerno at all, that I'd heard men actually screaming, an American, you know, screaming, my leg, and so on. It's very unnerving.
Sounds as though what happened was that this was harassing fire that happened to be very unlucky for you or for your Americans.
Yes, that's right. I think that's right. It was not a sustained... It certainly wasn't a barrage. They were having a go, and they could hardly miss something or other. Then there was a most colossal air raid with anti-personnel bombs.